Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Merity Hancock, the fourth president of Empire State College. Dr. Hancock is widely recognized for her expertise in the delivery of innovative education across campuses and international borders. In her role as president, Dr. Hancock continues to lead Empire State College in new initiatives while maintaining its dedication to academic quality and cutting-edge educational research, innovation, and delivery. Prior to joining Empire State College as president, Dr. Hancock was vice president at Central Michigan University Global Campus, responsible for delivering academic program at CMU's remote campuses, military and community college locations, and online programs. Previously, she held both teaching and administrative leadership positions at the University of Maryland University College, joining that institution in 2000. Dr. Hancock holds a PhD in Urban Services and Education Administration from Old Dominion University, an MBA from Claremont Graduate University, and a Bachelor of Arts in Economics from Scripps College. Additionally, she has a certificate from the Institute of Educational Management from Harvard University, a certificate from the University Professional Continuing Education Association Leadership Academy at New York University, a certificate in Process Design and Implementation, Reengineering and Change Management from Michael Hammer and Company, and a certificate in Nonprofit Board Leadership from the Dorothy A. Johnson Center for Philanthropy. We'll talk about her new role as president at Empire State College and much more. But first, welcome Dr. Merity Hancock.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Why'd your parents name you Merity?
I'm the last out of five. They started with Bill and got increasingly creative. And all I can say is thank goodness they stopped after me, because I'm not sure what would have come next. I have an Aunt Merity and a great Aunt Merity.
Oh, is that right?
If you hang out in Minnesota, there's a little cluster of Merities.
Wow. And Garrison has never done anything on this subject of the Merity phenomena in Minnesota?
No, I did find a Merity in a book once, but unfortunately she was a drug addict accused of murder, so I didn't really follow up on that one.
Yeah. Well, this is so interesting. We have interviewed some of your predecessors in the past about Empire State. Let's take a few seconds just to review what it is.
Empire State College was founded in the 70s with a host of schools that were coming out around that time, looking at innovative, creative ways to acknowledge learning, break down structures. The college now serves about 20,000 students with 70,000 alums, offering programs at the undergraduate and graduate level across a spectrum of disciplines and degrees. Our students largely architect their own degrees. That's becoming a bit of a challenge lately with some of the Department of Ed restrictions and those type of requirements. And that's really where we're going now, is how do we keep the best of our previous world and make sure we're in compliance with the larger federal and state mandates.
That's so interesting what you just said, because I didn't know about that. The Department of Ed changes in requirements that might affect a place like Empire State. What are they?
Certainly. Well, it's really around the financial aid regulations, that it's the Department of Ed needs to make sure that the financial aid money in this country, which is significant, is being used to progress students toward jobs where they can pay back loans, become employed, finish, make sure all of these things are happening. And the best way they know to do that, to get around just the plethora of academic institutions and offerings in the U.S., is to have restrictions around satisfactory academic progress, how quickly you move, make sure courses are transferable so they have common outcomes, make sure students progress into jobs where they can pay back their loans, that their loans aren't significantly out of whack with their income when they come out. Sometimes that works, in general, that works at odds with academic institutions, because by and large, we don't charge tuition based on the earning potential. A K-12 teacher is going to pay the same tuition largely as a business student, though their earning potentials are quite different, and we certainly need the teachers. So we're not really set up in some ways around that. Now, sometimes engineering programs charge more, you see that. But the other place we have it in a school like Empire State College, which really was very access-oriented, that was then Chancellor Ernest Boyer's vision, was how do we pick up these students who aren't finding their way in the traditional structures, either because of learning styles or maybe they're now adults, they have other responsibilities. How do we pick that up? So Empire State College was founded to get around that, find creative means to engage those students in more meaningful learning, to be flexible with time and structure. So with us, it's been a bit difficult. One of the things in our charter document was to take the timeline out. You need to learn. How long it takes you to learn is your journey. We will award it when you learn it. Now you can't do those types of things. You have to have a time around that process.
So they have to sort of sign a contract that says, I'll start now and I'll be done then.
It's the common definition of a term. If you have a, if you have gone to a traditional college, it's the 17-week term or the 15-week term. When you register, it's basically that contract.
Now, I have to confess, and I've had a very good experience, have been a mentor a couple of times for somebody at Empire State, a student at Empire State. I think in both cases that I did it, they were non-trads. They were people who were a little bit older. But one of the things I saw there, I don't want to put you on the spot, is that people distrust this a little bit because they think this is a way that people can get in easy and have life experience credits and that they don't do the same hard work people do in universities.
And we do hear that across non-traditional education. And I'll address it in two pieces. The life credit is something that is hard for people to understand. Some students and sometimes the common public can think, I get life credit for living. I get college-level credit for living. Well, you don't. You get college-level credit for college-level learning.
For what you know.
For what you know at a college level.
Right.
So a good example is one, the history buff, the Civil War history buff, who knows far more. They've done reenactments. They've read. They've studied. They know far more about history because of their own passion than they're ever going to get out of a 3-credit-hour class covering the Civil War period. So they can document that, they can write what they've done, they can journal, and they can prove to us that their knowledge is equal, if not superior, to what we would expect out of a History 101 course.
So how do you do that? I mean, first of all, I want you to know I'm on your side. I do believe exactly what you're saying. And I got to tell you, as a person who has taught in college situations for 40 years, I can tell you there are a lot of glassy-eyed students who will sit there, nod their heads, and write something down and take a test. And I have always found that the non-trads who come back into my classes are by far the best students I've ever had. But how do you assess it? Somebody comes to you and says, okay, I never got a BA. I want a BA. I want some credit for what I know. Take your Civil War buff.
We go through a process, and there is an organization. Cale has done a tremendous amount of work, and we were one of the founding organizations with Cale to get the grant to get them going in the 70s. How do you document this? How do you look for third-party documentation?
What is Cale? I'm sorry for interrupting.
Center for Adult and Experiential Learning.
Okay, so it's a
Council for Adult and Experiential Learning.
It's not the Empire State College.
No. It's a national association.
Right.
Schools can join it. Pamela Tate is the head of it. And we've worked with them on doing a tremendous amount of validation. What are the processes that go through that really help you pull out college-level learning versus the alternative might be for you to come in for a degree and say, but I've been doing this for 10 years, so I should probably have a degree. Well, if you've been doing the same thing for 10 years, it's 10 years of the same experience. It's not 10 years of additional experience. And those standards really help us boil that down with the student to understand if you've been a technician, it may be equal to some college level learning, it may not. But if you've done it for 20 years, it's not necessarily equal to 20 years of new college level additional learning. So the Cale standards really help break that down. And it's rigorous. It's time consuming on both the student and the evaluator because each one's new. The students can get frustrated saying, why do I have to prove it? Or I've shown you, I've told you. Well, we need to be very, very clear because of those skeptics to make sure, and we need to be clear for our own standards, to make sure that we've got the documentation, you've proven it, and you've pulled it together in a way that shows a comprehensive knowledge that would equal a course.
So how do you police it? In other words, look, there's always going to be somebody who tries to get away with something. How do you ferret them out?
We have faculty review. They're reviewed by professionals who look over the portfolios, who are trained on how to review the portfolios. And then we go through, and obviously our accreditors are interested in how we do it. So we get looked at there. And we use, you know, and again, we use Cale conferences to keep looking at best practices, best standards. We have faculty who keep the learning around it going. As there's new types of learning, how do you document it? And then there's some areas, the American Council for Education does it, for example, with the military. They go in and have evaluated military experience and military training. And so they will do it for us in that way. And it's standardized. We know what it equals. But they use faculty, again, to review it and to say, would you equate this to speech 101, for example? Somebody who completes instructor training in the military may come out with the equivalent of a speech course because of that training.
So out of the 120 or so credits, How many can you get for life experience?
Our students bring in, on average, about 20 to 30, I believe, saving them about $5,000 in tuition as well, which is a handy
So 20
chunk
to 30 really isn't that impressive. I mean, half would be somebody who's been in the trenches and has, you know, been the head of Toastmasters and wants a little speech credit or whatever. It seems to me that some of those, you know, the impression people have is that you can get a lot more than 20 or 30%. That's wrong?
You can get more. It's rare. One, it's got to go into a comprehensive degree plan. Students have to walk into something that is woven together. And at Empire, we're relatively flexible within that, as long as it makes sense for where the student wants to go, what they're looking to do. And it depends on their program. If you want to be an artist, that degree plan, outside of the general education requirements mandated by the state, can be quite flexible. If you want to be a CPA,
we're
pretty strict to make sure you meet the requirements to be a CPA. But it's to get a lot of unique hours at the college level. It's not a gimme. You don't get it by virtue of being old.
Yeah. Now, how does it work? When I taught at New Paltz for all of those years, there was an on-campus place at Empire State College. And I want to point out that we're talking to Dr. Merity Hancock, who's the head lady there. So does every campus have an ancillary part of Empire State College?
No, we are more on community colleges than four-year colleges. So we are on some four-year campuses. I do not believe we're on New Paltz anymore. We are in Plattsburgh. We have 34, 35 locations around the state. We are the state's only statewide college, and that's by virtue of our charter. We were meant to be everywhere and provide our students. Now about half of our credits are online. We really work to provide our students the opportunity to go online, to go into a location, to meet with a mentor. And our mentor are faculty mentors. That term is being used in a lot of different ways now in higher education. But we mean, when we say mentor, it's a faculty. And as you've mentored somebody who really knows that student, understands their degree goals, where they're going, what their strengths and weaknesses are, where they need to build. So we try and have mentors around the state. So students have the point of being able to use them virtually if that works, if they want to take classes online, if they want to take small group studies around the state, if they want to take hybrid, if they're looking for a one-on-one individualized study because it's a very unique area they want to study.
What gets you angry personally? I mean, you're sitting at your desk and you hear something. Is there something that really gets you burning?
I alluded to it earlier. I got burning a little bit with some of the requirements where they wanted to evaluate schools on debt load to earnings.
Explain that for those of us who are somewhat challenged.
And I will say the federal government has stepped away from that some. So though I took advantage of any opportunity I had with anyone from the Department of Education to share my thoughts on it. They were looking at evaluating schools on the earnings your students made. And so to debt load. And we educate at Empire State College, we educate a lot of people who are interested in the social services, in teacher education.
Sure.
And I became concerned that it will become in a school's best interest to turn away from those programs and stop investing in them and invest in business, invest in IT, invest in sciences. And not that those aren't important, but there's this whole piece that keeps our society moving that is underappreciated, certainly by the income equity.
So let me get this straight. The feds are saying, let's see if college is worth it. Turns out to be worth it. And one of the ways we're going to judge whether it's worth it is, what's the likelihood that you'll be making a commensurate amount of money with what you've invested?
Yes.
And you are pointing out, I think quite correctly, that there's a big difference between, you know, you could be the head of a Merrill Lynch branch, or you could be doing social work in the El Barrio.
Mm-hmm.
And that's no way to judge these things.
Yes. And if you're evaluating a school, you run the risk. It's a little bit of the same challenge we have a bit with completion rates. Obviously, we all need to be measured on completion rates. We want students to complete, but access-oriented schools, by and large, their mission is to take students. For us, the vast majority of our students have started and stopped. So they're at some point at risk already because they've at one point decided to stop going to school. But our challenge and our goal and our mission is to reinvest and make education available. If we're measured entirely on completion rates and you start these scorecard ranking systems of the colleges, you make it in the college's best interest to move away from these students, go toward the gifted, keep fighting for those who won't need extra resources, move away from first generation, move away from English as a second language, move away from all those pieces that we need to move towards. So those are, when I get frustrated, it's around those. That tends to be my soapbox, if you could not tell.
Well, one of the things it seems to me that you have a problem with is that the same standards which are applied to four-year or two-year colleges are being applied to you. And that's clearly not appropriate when you're dealing with this diverse audience that you're dealing with.
And I would say most two-year colleges would agree with the same concerns I have. Most two-years would say, while we're seeing an increasing number of honors students and those students choose to do their first 2 years at a community college, they still own a strong mission to access-oriented and to first generation. So most two-year presidents would feel the same way I do. It's the schools and the state access schools as a whole face the same issue, that we're educating the bulk of the students. And we're educating the bulk of the students that can go one of two ways. They cannot get the college degree. They can hope they stay healthy and keep their job that is largely built on a young, healthy body, or they can go to college. And somebody's going to put the services around them and meet them and create the environment to get them through that academic degree. So if they want to move from perhaps a physical career to more of a knowledge or desk career, they can do it. I'm on the more extreme side because our goal really is broad access. SUNY Board of Trustees just put a definition of inclusion and diversity out. When we look at that definition, I think 2% of our students do not fall in it. So it's ironic when we look at a chief diversity officer to meet their needs, we have about 2% of students who would not fall within that category that they've created. So we're on the extreme side, but there's a broader movement of schools that are at risk if we keep with this focus on the ones you know will get through.
Way before my 45-year marriage, I knew a young woman, and I met her years later, who went to a very exclusive women's college, and she dropped out like a year before she graduated, and I said to her, "What'd you do that for?" She said, "Well, if you graduate from this particular place, you've missed the point of the education." Now, I know it's not exactly on line with what you've been talking about, but isn't there a place for people to go which you don't have to graduate from in order to get credits, in order to enhance your life?
That's largely a professionally focused conversation around micro-certifications.
Give us an example of what profession you're talking about.
Largely, I would say around technology, where you can get a bundle of skills.
Yeah.
Business can be the same way. Science may be the same way. Art could be the same way. If you want to open your own business, a lot of our students are, we have dancers in the city who know eventually they're not going to be able to dance. And they've watched numerous of their friends open dance studios and fail. So they're coming to us saying, we want to understand the relationship between the dance business and business. They may or may not need a full degree. Most of our students do go on. It's a pride point. It's what they want is the full degree. But they could go for a little micro credential, a little entrepreneurial credential that pulls together a little bit of business law, a little bit of marketing, a little bit of human resources, a little bit of accounting, and clusters them into a certificate. Those are being heralded in a lot of ways by industry and are a great way to get people jump-started, where, especially if you're a part-time student, it can take forever. If you think through, if 4 years felt like a long time to a traditional student, imagine a part-time student. So these give them building blocks. And you hear the chancellor speak quite a bit to that. And Empire State College is working closely with her on that.
Is she talking Empire State? Is she your champion on that? Or is Nancy Zimpfer talking everyone, including all the four-year colleges, when she starts talking about not necessarily graduation?
She's speaking to everyone. SUNY as a whole, she and I both expect Empire State College to play a significant role in that piece because our charter speaks to breaking down the constructs of curriculum. We don't know if, you know, 120 credits suddenly makes you a much better person than 100 did. It's a random number. It's a packaging piece to it. So we're working very closely to say, what set do you need to be successful in a piece of that? The risk with that, I think, and this goes a little bit, and I'm one of these people, I came from a private, small women's liberal arts college.
Which one?
Scripps College.
Oh, Scripps, of course.
So one of the things I've always said, and I think you hear this from a lot of people, my MBA got me my first job. My liberal arts education got me my presidency. And it got me the jobs after my first job.
Interesting.
And that's one of the fears I think we have a little bit. And if I were to interview somebody here at WAMC who's hiring a technical person, they might be right to hear the technical skills we want, here are the engineering skills we want. if you speak to somebody who, a president, they say, I'm looking for a lot of the softer skills that come from a liberal arts background, the fuzzy thinking, the connective tissue that pulls it together. So that is a little bit of the fear as you break down into just the certificates. Do you end up with people who can get the first job, but once it gets fuzzy, once it's okay, now start leading people, now start building diverse teams. We're seeing that a lot in the health professions. Do they have those skills? Have they had to deal with other positions, other challenges? You know, who taught you to keep a straight face when you're on a panel with somebody you completely disagree with? You know, how do you learn to process that information and move it forward?
I never learned how to do that, by the way.
Maybe an unfair question. And I don't know if you get a lot of people interested in take a liberal arts certificate. Let's do a liberal arts micro credential. That doesn't hold the same passion as a let's take a Microsoft credential or let's take a SAP credential or something like that.
We're talking to the very bright, obviously, Dr. Meredy Hancock, the fourth president of Empire State College. Well, you know, the head of the union, the UUP, was here this morning doing a commentary. And his big thing is adjuncts and the exploitation of adjuncts. So where do you get your faculty from?
We use both.
Full-timers.
We use both full-time tenure-track faculty. We have a cadre of about 200. And then we have between about 500 and 800 use of adjuncts during a year. That's a tough one.
That's why I asked.
And I've adjunct. And
you've adjuncted.
I've adjunct in places where I've worked, but I've adjunct. I know how much work it is. If you break out the hourly rate, it's not too impressive when you put in all the prep time. Adjuncts tend to be incredibly dedicated. So I think they're so passionate about it. They probably put in a lot more time than people think. Uniquely, I did my dissertation and did work on adjuncts.
Did you? What did you find?
Part of it around, and this is back in the day, a couple decades ago, that adjuncts as a whole score as well as full-time faculty in effectiveness, but they tend to be more disparate. Full-time faculty tend to fall into kind of a band. They're not as many really great. They're not as many really bad. Whereas adjuncts are really tend to be all over the place, but in the norm, they fall together.
Well, I don't know. You know, our producer here is David Gustina, and he's an adjunct in the journalism department at SUNY. And when our interns come in, they all have Popeyes, and they say, Professor Gustina, what are you doing here? They don't make any distinction between the full-timers and the part-timers.
They don't. In some of the fields where we run into the issue a little bit, is it's hard to stay up on industry. And as we're looking at more people coming out knowing technology, are you up on the latest systems? Do you understand that piece? So the academic practitioner, which is your best adjunct faculty because they understand the link between the practice and theory and
they
the academic link.
Yes.
Yes, but they link it to theory. So if you get the academic practitioner adjunct faculty, they're fantastic because they're in the industry, but they're dedicated to the education side of it. You really, I think in the best world, you want faculty exposed to both. But I don't think that's where UUP was going with it, obviously. I think they're going around the pay and the hours.
Sure.
And that's a difficult battle. When we're trying to keep the cost of education down, it's a hard battle to have. Adjuncts give you a lot of the flexibility that full-time faculty don't. You can be more nimble in the programming for what students want. They bring, again, we were talking about an academic practitioner brings the relationship to industry and today's industry into the classroom. It's not somebody who studied it 20 years ago. And we see this a lot of times
Absolutely.
In the IT fields.
You're right.
So it's a tough battle. I wish there were more resources to go around in a lot of ways.
We're talking to Dr. Meredy Hancock, president of Empire State College. So I guess my question would be, do you have to award, like every other college president, tenure, for example? Somebody comes up and they want to get tenure. It's getting rarer and rarer, harder and harder to do, but you're the top. So what do you do? Is it on you to say yes or no?
It is on me to say yes or no, but there's a process it goes through. There's a peer review process. Mm. There are bylaws that state what has to happen. So somebody should know what their package is as they move forward. And different schools rank different things. A university center is going to rank research and impact scores of that research quite high. We're a teaching institution. And, you know, again, we try and keep our charter pretty tight. A lot of our research is around, and going back to Ernest Boyer, the scholarship of teaching and learning. We want to know what makes you click, what makes our students interact with the information and hold on to it and make it their own and grow it.
Hard to evaluate, isn't it?
Very hard. Very hard. And tenure is always somewhat subjective. You try and keep it from being subjective. But by the time it gets to the president, it's gone all the way up to the academic division, including the provost. So they've gone peer review, dean review. It goes up. So you're very rarely truly making a decision unless it's a very controversial. You know, there's always that one that pops up where the different committees have disagreed or the vote's been very split.
You know, Dr. Hancock, I'm an old guy. I'm 74 years old. I've been around for a long time. I remember at Rutgers, there was a left-wing professor, Dr. Eugene Genovese, and this caused terrible disruption, you know, whether he got tenure or not, and a lot of pressure on the president, that kind of thing. Do we have anything like that anymore? Do you ever feel that there comes a point at which somebody who you think is probably good in a classroom, but who is suspect because of their politics or any of that?
I think you're always going to get that. Tenure is it's a little bit like getting your doctorate. It's a little bit of a club. And so there's always a bit of a subjective nature.
Yeah, but if it's club, often there are those who say, why is Shartok got all of these 200 people taking his American government class and nobody wants to take mine? So the club now is better off with somebody in the middle range than somebody who is going to give me a hard time.
And that's where you want policy as much as possible. The UUP would certainly know this. You want clear guidance to say, people, we have to take the personal out of this. You know, it's an election year. It's a great time to have personal bias in a lot of decisions. And you really want something that says, we take that out of it. We set the goals. We said what it would, you know, we set the identifiers on what we're looking at to be a good teacher. And in higher ed, it's hard because there is that balance. You don't want a faculty that everybody agrees with all the time. You want to stir a little bit. How do you deal with that disconcerting thought? How do you handle that? And, you know, that doesn't mean I want all of my faculty to be out in disparate extremes.
No.
But part of the education experience is learning how to deal with somebody who's introducing something you don't agree with. But you want tenure to stay out of that. Tenure should be as clean as a process as it can be, with clear expectations, faculty that understand it, which also then helps with the internal politics, because you do within the faculty always have a senior junior faculty threat. And the clearer your promotion and tenure standards are and processes are, the less that type of what you hear is faculty bullying can take place, because a junior faculty knows that I've hit the requirements. I've done my part, versus the, you know, Alan doesn't like me and he's a senior faculty member, so I better vote as he wants me to vote on this issue, or I better do whatever he says so that he'll support me in tenure. You want policies and procedures that steer away from that and protect your good faculty.
Have you ever had a major scandal at Empire State?
Okay, can I knock on wood now? We have not since I have been there. And I don't think we've had one. I have not heard of the Empire State College scandal. And I hope I have not just jinxed myself.
I'm sure you haven't, but you realize, of course, me being where I'm sitting and you being where you're sitting, it's a reasonable question to ask. Because it seems to me that there is the possibility that I could see of a mentor taking somebody on, say, yeah, I'll get you through and I'll do that, and making it a little too comfortable. Yeah, you have to write a paper for me or something like that.
And we're set up to hopefully keep that from happening because there is a committee. Almost when you work through our programs, it's a little bit like going through a doctoral committee or a graduate project committee at the undergraduate level. So you work with your mentor and you design a program, but then it has to be defended to an external committee of faculty, meaning external outside of that mentor-mentee. So it still has to go through the standards. It has to show rigor. It has to identify why it was developed as it was, to meet the students' goals. And there are obviously checklists that say it just has to meet basic degree goals.
Let me ask you about sexism. You're a woman. You're a college president. Have you come across in your experience problems between men and women because of the unique function of Empire State College?
No, though we've become a little smarter. I think back in the day, and this was before my time, that mentors would sometimes meet their students at a coffee shop or that type of thing. And we're smarter with that now. We say meet in the office. Don't let any potential issue arise if you're asking from that side of the vulnerability. Within the college, we're relatively well balanced. Higher ed as a whole tends to be heavy in women in some areas, certainly not in the presidencies and positions like that. Myself grew up in a very large family with a lot of boys, so I don't, if I'm being confronted with it, I don't always realize it. I think I just plow through. So I'm not always a good one to answer on that. I grew up in a dog-eat-dog world of boys and girls, and everyone play together and Well, you have to survive dodgeball as well as the next person. So I don't know.
I hated that game. Being a little guy. Talk to me about the award of $400,000 for your BS in health science.
That's, I think, fantastic. This is part of the investment fund from SUNY, and it's a great opportunity. And going to those building blocks a bit, this grant really is around building on top of students who go to the community colleges and making a clear pathway for people in the various health professions to go on to the next level.
Like a phlebotomist.
Yes, it could be a phlebotomist, which I'm not exactly sure what their whole academic requirements are, but yes.
You got to be able to get blood from somebody, I believe.
That's
okay, so there are stages in the development
yes.
of that kind of career, and you want to mirror that in what you're offering so that the next job up is available to somebody through Empire State?
And that you haven't lost any credits along the way. Yes, so you went to a community college, you became a radiological technician.
Sure.
What are your next options after that? And the person may say, I want to go more into an administrative side. So we're specifically setting up this degree to offer pathways. So it could be, is there a certificate within more or a higher level of certification? So, for example, with the RN to BSN, it's a very clear path. MSN, some of these programs have very clear licensing and certification pathways. Some of our folks are saying, I want to go into more of the administration side of it. I want to be more of a head nurse who's doing the administrative team side of it. So we're looking at having both technical pathways as well as health sciences and health administration pathways. And then that falls neatly into a suite of master's programs that we're building out as well that could then take them to the next level with an MBA or that type of programming.
So when somebody gets a graduate degree from you, as opposed to an undergraduate degree, is it much the same? In other words, you have a mentor, you do a contract, you propose what you're going to do, or is it different?
Most of the graduate degrees are more structured. Some of them are education, so that's a structured environment. The MSN is structured. MBA is pretty structured. There's flexibility in it if you want healthcare administration. There's different pathways you can take, but there's an expectation when somebody has an MBA that they have had certain courses and come out with certain content, knowledge, and mastery. So at the graduate, it's not as flexible. We do have a program that is more flexible around that, more in the arts and humanities, where students can bring together. And it's really people who have a love of learning and want to pull it together a little bit in the Renaissance degree piece and take it to a higher level of learning. So we do have that opportunity. But our graduate programs are largely more structured.
So Dr. Meredy Hancock, how did you get your job?
The right time at the right place, I believe.
When you saw it, is that something you said, I want this?
You know, I did, because I come from, as I said, I grew up, I went to a small liberal arts women's college. Loved it, got to benefit from sitting outside the coffee house with my faculty, solving world problems as I saw them at 19. Then I went on and became a military spouse and went on to get a PhD where I became from Old Dominion University. While it was a great institution, I was a number I had to process through while my husband was deployed, while I was raising kids and try and move through that way. So I really saw the access side in a different piece. And during that period, I just flopped into the opportunity to teach for a military, an institution that served the military. And I loved the population of people who were figuring out with very little money, and these are lower level enlisted folks, how to find the time and money for books to go back to school and make it work. And I became passionate about access. Somewhere during that though, we really pushed into the idea that the non-traditional student only wants the learning. Get it done. Tell me what I need to know. Be done with it. And I couldn't lose this feeling of what I loved about my undergrad. And my master's was also at a very small school with that same feel. And when I came to Empire State College, what I loved is they were fighting with that. How do you hit access? How do you hit scalability? How do you make it available to the masses without losing that really personal connection to the educational journey? How do you prepare somebody for the first job they want to get, but really make them an educated citizenry? So while Empire State College doesn't have all the answers, they were having all the conversations. So when I saw it, I knew it. I didn't know if they knew they wanted me, but I knew I wanted them.
So what was the process like getting the job?
A lot of interviewing, a lot of talking with people. Presidency searches are very open by and large. So I was fortunate in the institution I came from that my boss at Central Michigan University was very supportive. Sometimes that can be a concern because they know you're searching.
They don't want to lose you.
Yeah, but he was very, very good and supportive with it. And I think takes pride. You know, I see him now and he calls me his first president because of his president, I was the first one who worked for him to become a president. And that helped a lot. That type of leadership support is tremendous. And he still operates as a mentor for me today. But you submit a long, feels long, letter trying to help the search committee know you is something better than your CV, trying to get them excited. And that, to me, it's a personal piece because you want it to be a good match. I don't think somebody wants to be a president somewhere where if you don't feel the love and the passion of the institution, it would be an awful job.
We have all of these businesses that go out and find college presidents on contract. And then they come to the search committee and they say, here are five names. Is that a dangerous thing?
I don't think so. I prefer to deal with the search committee if I'm dealing with a high-level position.
Sure.
And certainly a search committee handled the Empire State College piece of it. It allows the candidates to have some candid conversations to see if it's a fit. The search committee only wants to bring in motivated, highly qualified individuals. So they'll help you decide if this is a fit for you. Where you wouldn't want to have that conversation with the search committee yet. You want to feel it out. And you don't apply for a presidency on a whim. It takes a lot out of you. It's public. Everybody can ask you anything they want to ask you, and they should. You know, you don't do it for kicks. So you want to make sure you feel good about it, that you think you're a qualified candidate and you think it's somewhere you want to be. And the search committees really help, or search firms really help vet that. On the school side of it, they also help. You don't do presidential searches every day. So they're very good with giving guidance. And here's, you know, here are things to ask. Here are things you might do. Here are background checks. We'll do reference checks. And here are types of reference checks that people tend to ask for presidential candidates. Things you might want to know that you wouldn't necessarily think of asking. So they bring a lot of expertise from doing it. So in the case of SUNY institutions, you still go to the campus. You still interview very, very publicly, and you go to SUNY and you interview with the chancellor and you meet with the board of trustees. So they still get their hands around it, but it's a much smaller group by the time they get to you.
Do you remember the time you first met Nancy Zimpher?
I do.
What was that like? The chancellor, for those who are listening.
You know, she sold it for me because there was a lot of talk about Open SUNY. I wasn't quite sure what was going on there. Systems can be odd places to work. I was in Maryland where we had a system, Michigan. There's absolutely no system. So that relationship with the chancellor was good. And what I appreciated, she told it like it was right out there. She got right to
She's right
been
to
in
the point. These studios sitting right where you are many times. So we're used to that.
So you know her style. So for me, I liked it. I didn't feel like I was trying to read her. I knew what she wanted from a president. I felt like I could go to her and say, Nancy, I've got this. And candidly, I felt like I could go to her and say, Nancy, I think I might have screwed this one up.
Yeah.
And she would work with me.
What if a cheap tin horn politician tried to lean on you to get something done for his brother-in-law's sister-in-law, that kind of thing? Do you have to have a certain kind of, first of all, has it ever happened? And second of all, do you have to have a certain kind of character to either fold or not fold?
I think you do. Yes, it happens. I will tell you, it has not happened to me in New York, but it has happened to me previously. You do need to know the support of the people around you. Yeah, I've been pretty strong early on with you don't litigate a degree, you earn a degree, because that's the go-to piece a lot of times often is I'll sue. And you can't be afraid of people suing. The opposite side of that is I will call my Uncle Harry, who's the chair of the board, or something like that.
And you don't mean I will. You mean
but,
that
no,
who's
yeah, the person,
you
Yeah, the yet. Person who wants the degree or wants you to turn your back
right.
on a certain requirement or something, or just call a paper done. Sometimes where you'll see it is around graduate programs where there's a significant research paper at the end. They would like you just to call it done for me. And I've never crossed that line into the faculty turf. I have, you know, faculty, you need to be responsive. You need to work with the student. But I have never, ever crossed the line into you need to approve something that does not meet our standards. That would be real dangerous territory. And I think once you do it once, you've opened Pandora's box. It's a learning contract between the student and the faculty member and any administrator who tries to second guess that. And we always have policies around other faculty can look at it. You just really want to stay out of that. And I sleep very well at night because I have now. I've had some times like, oh, how am I going to dance around this one? And I'm pretty strong with it. And so we just do not do that here. And candidly, if you hold a degree from here, you're glad we don't do that. And people do get that.
I had the experience of having a county political chairman, Republican, and a state senator go to my president at New Paltz and demand that I get fired because he didn't like what I was saying or writing in my Legislative Gazette newspaper or the rest of it. And he just said, well, I can't do anything about it. He's got tenure. Thereby, I've quite frequently thought, being the first and last time, that tenure did what it was supposed to do. Anyway, you know, I like to think that that's a tough thing. That president eventually got fired by the Republican administration at the time. They pressed him out because he had put on a sex conference in which one of the first vagina monologue performances was given, and this became a big thing in the tabloids. Those are the kinds of things you got to worry about.
Which is funny because those now have been that show has pretty much made its rounds to every college campus.
But not on the first one.
No. And you do. It's a balance. There's a lot to being a president that's a dance. One of, I think, the goals, and we talk about this certainly at Empire State College, is faculty have positions, students have their positions. You want to allow people to have their positions without making them the position of the college. And I think that's something to be real clear on, that the college does not have a political position. The college does not own this faculty's position. They're allowed to have their position. And as long as the faculty member is still open to open dialogue in their courses and respecting other people's positions, you're good, tenured or not, really.
In every university, every college that I've ever had anything to do with, there's always this issue of faculty governance. We want to tell her what to do, and she's operating like an autocrat. And there's always that sort of tension. I've always believed, hey, let the college president run it and go away. But there's always the insistence on this fiction of faculty governance. You'll probably take a different view of this, but maybe you could react to what I've just said.
I wish you would go down some of the hard questions. One of the things with Empire State College, because we're distributed across the state, we actually rely on governance in a different way.
So what is governance for Empire State?
Governance is really, from my perspective, and we have people who would disagree, and when I first met with our Senate, I explained, you know, governance is not co-management, that the chancellor interviewed one person for the presidency. She didn't interview each Senate to run the college.
And I like it.
That said, being informed helps you keep your job. So for us, governance, and we're we came in the 70s, we're a very social equity college. So we actually have an all-college Senate.
And where does it come from? Does it meet once a year or twice a year?
It meets 6 times a year.
And
but
where
it
do
polls
they
from everyone in Saratoga. They come to Saratoga, but we have our support staff have representation on Senate, our professional staff have representation, and our faculty. So we have a unique Senate. And if I can give you we have some pretty aggressive discussions and dialogues at Senate. But because people have to come from around the state, we have a whole day Senate. So we actually stop in the middle and break bread. And I love this about Empire State College because I think it's a logistical thing that happens, but it says so much about us that there can be a very active and maybe not too cordial discussion around some of the things we're doing.
There can be some dissonance.
Yes. And then you go and you eat with somebody.
So what
and people mix up at tables.
So what you feed them means a great deal. Do you ever strategize of we'll give them a better meal or a worse meal because we want them to be more amenable?
I very wisely do not control the menu. But no, I think it's pretty much the same thing. They get sandwiches and salad. We don't. I hadn't thought about that. Maybe give them some good comfort food and
Sure. Things
that make you feel good about yourself or lower the blood sugar depending on the afternoon session.
Interesting. That's exactly what I was thinking.
I hadn't thought through that much.
I'm very diabolically clever. Let me ask you a question, Dr. Meredy Hancock. You mentioned your children before, so I'm going to go there. If one of your children comes to you and say, I've been accepted at Harvard, but I think I'd rather go to Empire State College, would you look at them and say, are you crazy?
No. No, I would not look at them and say, are you crazy at all? In fact, my eldest son is married, served in the Marines, is married down in Virginia, and I really think we would be the college for him if he lived in New York. He wants face-to-face instruction, and I sit here and I think about this. We would be a great college for him looking at his experiences. He's musically inclined. He worked in electronics in the Marines. And helping him just think about what does he want to do that's You know, we can't enjoy every day at work, but what does he want to do that's going to, you know, light him up for a career? And what does he want to study, and how is he going to study it, and what's relevant to him? I would love to see him there. So I will say I have a senior now who's looking at colleges, and she's looking very closely. She wants to go either into a PhD or med school. So I would not recommend it for her, that she's very scientifically oriented. She wants labs. That's not our repertoire. So for her, I would not recommend it. But I would love, and actually, you know, so I'll get into my hokey side, but when I sit on stage and I watch people graduate, I would love to watch one of my children walk across the stage and be able to hand them their diploma.
That's great. You mentioned earlier in our conversation, and I wanted to catch up with it, that you went to an all-women's college. And you know, my wife went to Skidmore, and so you're up there in Saratoga. Wouldn't have had it any other way. It was all women at the time. What are your feelings about that?
I will tell you, I cheated a little bit. Scripps College is part of the Claremont Colleges.
I know that
so
well.
It's
yeah.
So you walk across the street, and you have Harvey Mudd, you have Pitts, you've got Claremont McKenna. So you're not as designed into a straight women's college. They kind of found me, to be honest, and I pushed back a little bit with my parents. I wanted to ride rodeo, and I thought that was my career. I wasn't very good at it, but I thought that I should head out that way. And they pushed pretty hard that I go a different way. Luckily, Scripps College came up with a really great package, because I think it was the best move of my life.
So there were men around. So it wasn't as if,
Could you
cross-register from one campus to the other?
Absolutely. In fact, I studied economics, and Scripps did not have an economics program when I studied. So I did we had an undergraduate thesis. I did that with faculty at Harvey Mudd. I did, which was largely a men's engineering college. I did classes with faculty and took classes across the other campuses to make up an economics degree, but I did graduate from Scripps.
What is it about you in the military? You married a military man, your kid is in the military. Is there a part of your personality that is basically, you know, oriented towards military design?
I could never be in the military. That would not fit my own sense of unwillingness to salute people. That said, I am incredibly supportive of our men and women in uniform. Working with them, especially with our enlisted troops, they put so much work into it. And the military provides this great social value for people who don't know what they're going to do coming out of school, to have a place, another option other than college, to go, to mature some, to find themselves. You know, I wish we could keep them safe and healthy. I'm a little bit passionate on the enlisted side because most of us don't have, and my son served when in his enlisted. And I have to say, it was quite different. My sister is a retired Navy officer, a medical doctor. My ex-husband was an F-14 Rio, who was there for 20 years. The enlisted world is entirely different. And, you know, watching my son go through it, I was very happy that I'd spent the bulk of my career supporting it because, you know, I say kids, and that's becoming a broader term as I get older. But they deserve the support. And most of us don't have that experience to know really what they go through. It is not the same thing as an officer going through the military. I guess I'm passionate about it. I don't know how it happened, but I'm passionate about military education, opportunity. I'm very, very concerned. A lot of these kids have no clue what to look for in a college. They come out with the biggest resource they will ever have, maybe other than a house with their GI Bill. All these schools are banging on them to get the money from it. They don't know what they're looking for. They don't. And as we've cut military funding, they can't get the support in the military to help them decide which school is best for them. So they're an at-risk population in a way with a great bank account to fund school. And we want to make sure they get into good programs. They study what they want to study. They end up with a reputable degree. And they really get the return on that investment. So, okay, that's another soapbox I have.
Okay, fair enough. But you're the mother of a Marine. Would you have sent troops into Iraq on the basis of weapons of mass destruction, which many of us knew didn't exist? And I am being unfairly provocative here.
You know, interestingly, during that time, I was in D.C., and the overriding feeling was it did exist. You know, I don't know. I would never run to be president of the United States, so I wouldn't have to answer that one.
Okay, you don't have to answer.
I don't know if I would or not.
Yeah. Are you a political person, though? Do you think about politics a lot?
A lot, yes.
Really? What's your sounding board for that?
You know, for me, I look at it in different ways. I think I break down issue by issue.
Yeah.
And I'll steer clear from politics, but I look at defense under one lens. I look at welfare under another lens. I look at education under another lens.
Does Empire State have a relationship with the military? In other words,
yes.
You obviously have your share of people who take courses at Empire State in the military.
Yes, we do. We do have a relationship with the military. And ironically, I was on a panel long ago that worked with the Office of Secretary of Defense's office in setting up best practices for military students to try and get some standards. And that was a bit of a precursor that went into the Department of Defense MOU that all schools who accept tuition assistance have to sign. So, you know, I have to live with a little bit of what we created.
Anything in there that turned you off?
No, some hoops in going through their technology, but they're really trying to make sure their students don't take courses that won't transfer. They're trying to make sure you understand that their students might get deployed at the last minute and you won't hold them to the same drop schedule. They're trying to make sure you have flexibility in when their students are deployed. Do you have virtual resources? We have an Office of Veteran and Military Education, OVME, that is really designed at understanding those needs of the military. So the standards put out by DOD, you have to charge them your lowest tuition rate. They want to make sure people aren't taking advantage of the fact that they know they come with money. They're really reasonable to try and take care of this population. We used to have a time when military would take courses, say they'd be in Heidelberg, and then they'd go to transfer, and they'd transfer bases, and the next school wouldn't take them.
Yeah, Maryland might not take what Empire State did.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And actually, I was at Maryland when I sat on this board, because Maryland is so large with the military. And they can't have that. These students kept getting put back to zero. When you said, well, New Paltz won't take the English you took at Maryland or whatever. And so the military got smart with that and said, we can't do these to these service members. We need to let them know up front what will transfer, where it will go, and those pieces. So that one, I don't have any, you know, there aren't complaints around that you have to do certain things to participate other than what really is in the best practices of the service members.
Well, this has been a wonderful time. I want to apologize if I've asked you anything that I shouldn't have.
That would have been totally unexpected.
Yeah, but anyway, I like to try to keep it interesting. Our guest has been Dr. Merity Hancock, fourth president of Empire State College, and obviously a very bright lady. We're so delighted you came in and talked to us.
I enjoyed the conversation.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, president and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.